Today on The World, there are still lingering questions about the AstraZeneca vaccine and possible risks. But the head of the WHO has no doubts about it.
COVID-19 is a deadly disease, and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine can prevent it.
Also today, as the United Nations starts to focus more on systemic racism, a judge in Kenya says some fundamental changes must be made here in the United States.
You will probably never have a system where African Americans or people of color can walk the streets safely unless you deal with your love affair with a gun.
Plus, women in Europe are stepping on the gas and changing the world of auto racing.
We fight, we want to win, we want to go for the podiums.
When only a victory lap will do. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Great to have you with us this Friday. We begin today in Alaska, where it's typically cold this time of year. Yesterday, though, it was downright frigid, at least between U.S. and Chinese diplomats. They were gathered in Anchorage for their first high-level meeting since Joe Biden became president. And what's more, the squabbling took place out in the open during what was supposed to be just a brief photo op. Leading the U.S. delegation was Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
We do not see conflict. But we welcome stiff competition, and we will always stand up for our principles, for our people, and for our friends.
The China delegation was headed up by Foreign Minister and State Councilor Wang Yi and Yang Jiexie, the director of China's Central Foreign Affairs Commission.
So let me say here that in front of the Chinese side, the United States does not have the qualification to say that it wants to speak to China from a position of strength.
So what should we make of this? Is this posturing or is there real tension we should worry about? Susan Thornton spent nearly 30 years in the State Department focused on China and East Asia. Were you surprised by the bluntness of the remarks you heard yesterday, Susan?
Yeah, I was a bit surprised, Marco, and I think, frankly, it was a very unusual opening to a diplomatic meeting where both sides traveled all the way to Alaska to try to have a sit-down and air some kind of differences and come up with a constructive path forward.
So do you think the Chinese delegation arrived in Alaska agitated with the U.S., or were they responding off the cuff to what Antony Blinken said?
I think the Chinese were already on edge, probably arriving in Alaska because the U.S. had rolled out sanctions against officials in Hong Kong and sanctions against U.S. companies in the couple of days before the meeting. So I think they were prepared probably to respond in the way that they did, but it probably didn't need to be that way. I kind of feel that the Chinese remarks there show that this obsession by the U.S. of talking about coming from a position of strength is really a bit overweening at this point and probably, you know, a little bit unnecessary and counterproductive.
So to what degree do you think the Chinese remarks were for domestic consumption back home?
I think the remarks on both sides were for domestic consumption back home. But certainly the Chinese in responding to the U.S. remarks, you know, they would have had to do something like that, I think, before the cameras in order to not look as though they were being publicly dressed down.
So today there's a lot of hand-wringing that the tone of this meeting signals a new low in U.S.-China relations, that this pattern has gotten really, really bad. Should we be worried right now?
I'm worried. I think the Chinese were holding off on responding to a lot of what they considered to be provocations that came at the end of the Trump administration. And, you know, in the hopes that they could turn a new page with a new administration in the U.S., we'll see, you know, as the meeting ends, the statements come out about the conclusions of each side, you know, whether their hopes were ill-founded or not. But it wasn't a good indicator at the beginning there. And if they feel that this is really no prospect of improvement, I think we will see a new low.
You said you're worried, Susan. What are you most worried about?
Well, what I see happening is a sort of a growing estrangement, which I think if that happens and we can't find any productive paths forward, it will be very hard to keep us from drifting into kind of conflict or confrontation. And many, many historians have talked about the parallels in the tenor of the conversations to the beginning of World War I. And I think that should put us on notice. There are a lot of people talking about this Thucydides trap and the fact that the U.S. and China, because of structural power changes in the world, are actually, quote unquote, destined for war. A conflict between two major nuclear armed states would be cataclysmic for not just those two states, but for every country in the world. And so we need to pay attention here.
Susan Thornton, former acting secretary for the Asia-Pacific region in the State Department and currently a fellow at Yale's Paul Tsai China Center. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's stay on China and turn to the trial underway for Canadian businessman Michael Spavor. He and fellow Canadian Michael Kovrig have been in custody for more than 2 years on spying charges. Their arrests are widely seen as retribution for Canada's detention of Meng Wanzhou, the chief executive of Chinese tech giant Huawei. Her arrest by Canada was made at the request of the U.S. Spavor's hearing in Dandong, China today ended without a verdict. It could be years before he gets one. Michael Kovrig will go through a similar trial on Monday. The whole process has been shrouded in secrecy, as the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
2 years ago, Michael Kovrig was pulled off the street by Chinese security forces in the middle of the night. 2 days later, Michael Spavor was taken at the airport. They've been locked up in separate prisons in northern China, largely cut off from the world and their families. Advocates say they're not so much suspects as hostages, bargaining chips to secure the release of Meng Guangzhou. China won't reveal much about how they're being treated, but Peter Humphrey has some idea of what it's like. The British national spent 2 years, from 2013 to 2015, in Chinese detention, also on false charges of spying.
The whole design of the detention centers in China is aimed to crush the human spirit and the will to resist.
Humphrey says he was held in sordid conditions.
There was maybe a dozen detainees in one cell, and we had no furniture. We were sleeping on rough wooden floorboards. The toilet was a hole in the floor, effectively, in the corner of the cell. Food was being served through the bars of the door in doggy bowls. So it was appalling.
After a day or two, the interrogations began.
In the interrogation cell, usually you're in handcuffs and you are locked into a locking chair, and that chair is inside an iron cage. And the interrogators are normally on a raised podium. And usually there are at least three of them belting at you at the same time. There is never any genuine forensic police work done. They rely entirely on crushing people into making confessions.
Spavor and Kovrig have been in conditions like this now for 2 years and 3 months. Margaret McQuaig Johnston is a fellow at the Asia-Pacific Foundation of Canada. She's been following the Spavor and Kovrig cases closely.
The decision is already made. They're just going through the formality of a trial.
China is assuring the international community that Kovrig and Spavor are getting all their rights allowed under Chinese law.
And that's likely correct. But Chinese law does not follow any kind of due process and completely ignores the human rights of the individual.
Beijing wants to be seen as a credible international actor, projecting soft power and luring international investment. Pretty much every multinational corporation has offices in China, and millions of foreigners are living there. McQuaig Johnston says it's easy for them to forget they're in an authoritarian state.
I was in Shanghai when Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor were taken, and I mentioned it to a Chinese national who I was meeting with the next day. He told me that China has a list of 100 Canadians that they can pick up and interrogate at any time.
She suspects China has similar lists for other countries. As for Kovrig and Spavor, experts say their fates rest with the U.S. Their trials are taking place while Beijing and Washington hold high-level talks in Alaska. Guy Saint-Jacques, the former Canadian diplomat to China, told the CBC this is deliberate.
In China, there's no coincidence. It's clear that they want to send a message to tell the Americans, we are not going to concede. If you want to help the Canadians, you have to make concessions.
Concessions on trade, on Hong Kong, on human rights, and on the release of Meng Guangzhou.
All this to say that, in fact, we are in the hands of the Americans if we want to see some kind of outcome at some point.
Meanwhile, Veena Najibullah, Michael Kovrig's wife, says time is of the essence. She told the CBC that she isn't giving up.
Today, I was reminded of something that he said in one of his letters, that on a daily basis, he works to transform anger into determination and grievance into resolve. And he's working really hard to stay determined to be free one day and to come home.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Tanzania has a new president today. Samia Suluhu Hassan was sworn in following the death announced Wednesday of John Magufuli. Hassan will serve what's left in the late president's five-year term. Her predecessor had a mixed record. Magufuli had a reputation for being tough on corruption, but also increasingly authoritarian. He was also a COVID-19 skeptic. On the line with me now is The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi. She's in neighboring Kenya. Halima, what do we know about the new president?
Well, to start with, she's incredibly educated, both in Tanzania and abroad. She's also experienced. She has some more than 20 years of experience in government in Tanzania at both the local level as well as the national level. She served in ministerial positions. And recently, of course, she was the vice president under Magufuli. Something else that's interesting is that she comes from Zanzibar. Now, in Tanzania, Tanzania is a united republic. There's the mainland Tanzania, where Magufuli, the late Magufuli was from. And there's also Zanzibar, which is a semi-autonomous island, which means that it has somewhat of a separate government and it has its own elections, but it's still under Tanzania. And Tanzania also has a different demographic than the mainland. It's predominantly Muslim. And what's interesting about that is that in some ways, the new president kind of represents the very opposite of Magufuli in that way. She's a woman, she's Muslim, she's from Zanzibar. And Tanzania is a diverse country, and that's what the new president spoke about. She spoke about unifying that diverse country during her swearing-in ceremony.
Huu ni wakati wa kuzika tofauti zetu na kuwa wamoja kama taifa.
And that was her just saying that now is a time to set aside the differences in the country and to stand together and work together as a united country and as a united Tanzania.
As you reported on the show yesterday, Halima, the administration of John Magufuli was marked by his authoritarian rule. Does his successor, Samia Suluhu Hassan, does she share that reputation?
Not necessarily. I mean, of course, we'll have to see what happens to her when she's actually now leading the country. That said, she's known to kind of have the opposite personality as Magufuli. You know, he was a charismatic speaker. He was loud, had kind of a sense of humor, but she was more reserved, a bit more quiet. And that's something that one opposition leader, Tundu Lissu, who is currently living in exile in Belgium, he was an opponent of Magufuli, lost to him in the recent election. He told me a little bit about her, and this is what he had to say.
She's a quiet woman. She's sensible. I believe that she will not be like the late president was for 5 years.
Now, interestingly, the last time Lissu said he spoke with her was when she was visiting him at a hospital here in Nairobi after he was nearly assassinated and had to flee the country for the first time. And he said he's worked with her a lot as a member of parliament. So she's no stranger to him. And of course, when he says that he believes she'll be different from the previous president, he means that he's hoping she'll represent a change from Magufuli, especially when it comes to his human rights record, and even something as simple as acknowledging the problem of coronavirus in the country.
So hopes are there that President Hassan will be different from President Magufuli. I mean, it's only day one, but are there any signs that that is likely to happen?
And regular Tanzanians I spoke with today, some who supported Magufuli said, you know, you have to wait and see what happens. And even journalists like myself are waiting to see whether or not this new administration will open up more to the press, which has been a big challenge under Magufuli. If you remember, many of us were restricted from even traveling to Tanzania to report on the presidential election in October.
The World's Halima Gikandi filling us in on the new president of Tanzania, Samia Suluhu Hassan. Halima, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up later in the show, the U.S. is sitting on a pile of vaccines and is sending millions to Canada and Mexico. More on the terms of the deal coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Just north of Boston, you can visit Gloucester, the lobster shacks, the wharf where the fishermen set out to sea, the piles of nets, the salty air. It is evocative, and yet a new report out this week puts some of that romantic scene in check. Those boats that trawl the ocean bottom, dragging huge fishing nets along the seafloor, turns out that practice is really bad for the climate, like worse than airplane emissions. That may be hard to conceive, so we've got Enrique Sala with us to explain. Enrique was lead author on that study that calculated the climate impact of bottom trawling. Globally, it releases more carbon emissions than Germany. So, Enrique, your study found that bottom trawling is really bad. Where do those emissions come from? I mean, how does dragging nets across the seafloor result in carbon emissions?
Yes, the seafloor is the largest carbon storehouse on the planet. And that would be fine if we left that carbon and that sediment on the seafloor. But bottom trawling, by plowing the seafloor, disturbs the sediment and the carbon in it. And when that carbon is resuspended in the water, part of it turns to carbon dioxide.
Your study also proposes some solutions, like conserving some parts of the ocean from bottom trawling. You say that could reduce the climate impact, but it could also actually increase seafood catches. Can you explain that?
You know, today, only 3% of the ocean, less than 3% of the ocean, is fully protected from fishing, which means that 97% of the ocean is open to fishing. And the amount of fish we catch every year has been declining since the mid-90s. And over 3/4 of the fish stocks are overfished, meaning we are taking them out of the water faster than they can reproduce. But we know that when we close an area to fishing, marine life comes back spectacularly. On average, the abundance of fish increases sixfold within these protected areas. So our study has found that if we protect the right places in the ocean, that spillover effect would be much greater than the catch that would be lost by closing these areas. So there would be a net gain in fisheries catch. So the world would have more fish to catch than if we continue fishing almost everywhere. Now think of that 97% of the ocean that is open to fishing as a checking account where everybody withdraws, but nobody makes a deposit. And you don't need to be a banker to know what's going to happen to that account. We're going to absolutely deplete it.
So, Enrique, the conservation projects you describe also have a huge benefit for protecting biodiversity and wildlife. Do governments understand the dots that connect climate goals and the protection of wildlife?
The science is very clear. The economics are very clear that protecting nature is half of the solution to solve the climate crisis. Nature is our best ally when it comes to fight climate change.
It sounds like you're leaning on the hopeful side of things.
We have to. We have to because there is no alternative. You know, the question that we must ask ourselves is not how much nature can we afford to lose, but how much can we collectively restore? Because the wild that we have today is not sufficient to absorb all of our impacts. And we know that when we give the ocean space, when we give nature space, it has an extraordinary ability to bounce back. And I have seen it. We have no option. No, we should leave pessimism for better times.
Marine biologist Enrique Sala directs National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project. He's been speaking with us about the report he was the lead author on, connecting bottom trawling of the oceans to climate change. Enrique, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Today in Geneva, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights gave a progress report.
I met personally with a number of family members of women, men, and children of African descent killed by law enforcement officials.
Michelle Bachelet mentioned the trial of the police officer accused of killing George Floyd, and then she spoke of other police killings in which survivors are still seeking justice.
Many have told us of being refused access to evidence, denied timely and regular information, and even permission to recover the bodies of their relatives.
Judge Peter Herbert is chair of the Society of Black Lawyers, a UK-based group of African, Asian, and Caribbean lawyers. He joins us from Kenya. Judge Herbert, what do you make of High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet's speech today?
Well, I think it's very positive, and it is, in a sense, long overdue that there was an international focus on the legal system and the extrajudicial killings in the United States. For many decades, the U.S. justice system has been less than fair, to put it mildly, about its treatment of people of color.
So statements by the UN and by the US today seem to cast systemic racism as an international problem, which it is. Why is it also important that the Biden administration treat this as a homegrown American problem as well?
What the murder of George Floyd did, and Breonna Taylor and many others, it held a mirror up to American society. And whilst, yes, it is a problem around the world, it is at its vortex in the United States. And, you know, I hear many people, the Biden administration, say this is the greatest democracy in the world. Well, it's not, actually. A greatest democracy should protect the most vulnerable and the weakest in society at all levels.
What would you like to see the Biden administration doing that it is not doing right now?
Well, I think what it has to do is really have a commission to look at the whole of the U.S. justice system. I mean, just one of the many, many injustices is the fact that you have, I think, some 19,000 police forces in the U.S. And it's ludicrous. I mean, it's hard enough having 42 in the U.K. and keep an eye on what they do. So there's system change and also to hold the police accountable. It seems as if your love of your, not personally, but collectively, the love of the firearm gives a license to kill to those in uniform. And that, I think, has to be dealt with as part and parcel of the review of the justice system. You will probably never have a system where African Americans or people of color can walk the streets safely any time of day or night unless you deal with your love affair with a gun.
I take your point on firearms, but I mean, as to the number of police, the U.S. is a big country with 50 states. The U.S. does warrant more police than the U.K.
No, it's not about numbers. It's about what your police do. I'm sorry. I know exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, I was in charge of 36,000 police officers in London, and you regularly take down people who are mentally ill, white people as well, you know, and it is not about America's a big country. Nigeria is bigger. Brazil is almost as big, you know, so it's not about the size of the U.S. It's about your culture and your love affair with a gun.
We talk about the U.S. holding itself accountable for systemic racism and the historically brutal treatment of African Americans. In your view, Judge Herbert, what would accountability look like?
Well, I think accountability comes in many forms. I think it would be about rationalizing the number of police forces, because that is a guarantee for differential treatment and the postcode lottery of justice. Secondly, you must have elected bodies to which the police are accountable for policy and practice. It doesn't mean to say that you have a group of civilians having oversight of policing on the streets in Atlanta, but what it means is that they can have, as we did in London, a right of access to any police station, any time, day or night, and to intervene on the street even if we feel something is being done inappropriately or even unlawfully.
Judge Peter Herbert is chair of the Society of Black Lawyers. He was helping to explain the UN spotlight on systemic racism and police violence and the American response. Judge Herbert, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hello, Marco here. This past year, listeners continued to show their unwavering support for The World. Together, we raised over $100,000, thanks to the following people that helped us reach our goal. Mark Routhier, Stefan Gunther, Cynthia Craig, Robert R. Liu, M.D., Brian Goldman, Mike Haas, Nancy Cook, David Wilkins, Stephen Commons, and Brandon Ito. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners all around the world. The Jesuits are atoning for their role in slavery.
There's been a lot of come-to-Jesus moments, as we tend to call them, that have just been brutal, raw, and painful.
And for those of you in need of speed, how European women are changing auto racing, that's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. The United States is planning to send 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Mexico and Canada. Several European countries this week suspended the use of that vaccine, but the EU told them that the AstraZeneca shot is safe and effective, which prompted France, Germany, and Italy to resume using it. More on that in a moment. Many countries have been asking for help from the U.S., which is sitting on stockpiles of AstraZeneca doses. This would be the first time the U.S. would be exporting coronavirus vaccines. We've got the world's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, in Mexico City on the line with us. So this will be a vaccine loan, as I understand it, Jorge, for both Mexico and Canada. What are the terms of this deal?
That's right, Marco. Mexico will receive 2.5 million doses. Canada will receive 1.5 million. Both countries are supposed to pay back for these AstraZeneca vaccines by the end of the year. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki has acknowledged that in order to fully address the pandemic, a large proportion of the global population needs to be vaccinated. And as you mentioned just a moment ago, Marco, the United States is sitting on tens of millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine that are not being used in the United States, at least not yet, because they haven't been approved by the FDA. So many countries have requested the United States to help them out, among them Mexico and Canada. And so these two neighbors of the United States will be the first countries to receive an export from the United States.
So alone, is the United States getting anything else in return from this transaction?
It appears that perhaps the United States is getting something else in return. At the same time that the White House said that they were approving this loan, Mexico's immigration agency said that the country was going to close both its northern border with the United States and its southern border with Guatemala and Belize, which is interesting timing because we are now more than a year into the pandemic. This is the first time that Mexico takes a measure of this nature, and Mexico will continue to receive flights and tourism to the country. I spoke about this with Malaquias López Cervantes. He teaches public health at Mexico's National Autonomous University, and he is a former senior official in Mexico's Federal Health Secretariat.
The first thing I thought was, what a coincidence. The apparent reason for closing the border is to stop the spread of the virus, but the real effect is to stop migration.
Marco, this wouldn't be the first time that migration and migrants become bargaining chips in the relationship between the United States and Mexico. We'd had just a few years ago, the Trump administration, as it was renegotiating a trade deal for North America, pushing Mexico to much more aggressively patrol its southern border in order to prevent people from traveling by land to arrive to the southwest border and petition asylum.
So let me make sure I got this straight, Jorge. In Mexico's case, they're receiving these doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine in exchange for kind of monitoring the border or keeping the border closed?
Thank you for asking that, because officials on both sides are saying that this is just a coincidence. They happen to be two of the top issues that both countries are in regular dialogue about. But many, both public health observers and migration observers, say that the timing in which Mexico is announcing that it is closing its border with Guatemala and with Belize is very striking, that it happened at the very same time that the United States acquiesced to Mexico's multiple requests to help out in its vaccination process.
A coincidence that some experts can't ignore. It seems there are a lot of politics internally for Mexico. How is Mexico managing the vaccine rollout?
Well, Mexico is struggling a lot in its rollout process. Mexico was one of the first countries in Latin America to begin receiving vaccines back in December. And yet, at this point, only about 3% of the population has received a shot. And it seems that public health officials are not really being heard. I asked Malaquias López Cervantes, the former health official, about this. And here's what he had to say.
In Mexico, the Secretary of Health is almost an inexistent organization. The Secretary of Health only follows the orders that come from the President or the Secretary of Foreign Affairs.
So as you can see, Marco, people with intimate knowledge of the public health processes here in Mexico see that the health minister is in many ways non-existent. And the result of that is a lot of confusion. And that's a huge problem, because when you have the process that is so centralized and then eventually it gets punted to the states because the states are the ones that are administering the doses, when there's so much confusion in that handoff, then it slows down the process. So Mexico continues to be in big trouble with vaccinating its population.
That's Jorge Valencia, the world's Latin America correspondent in Mexico City. The AstraZeneca vaccine has been a hot topic the past few days across the European Union.
AstraZeneca suspendu.
Vaccine AstraZeneca.
La vacuna AstraZeneca.
AstraZeneca's corona vaccine.
Vaccine AstraZeneca.
Earlier this week, several countries stopped administering it over concerns that a small number of the millions of people vaccinated developed blood clots. But yesterday, European drug regulators gave the AstraZeneca vaccine an important thumbs up, confirming it is safe. We're joined by the world's Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens, Greece, and Ilana Gordon, who covers public health. Lydia, after this EU regulator announcement, are countries now resuming efforts to get shots of AstraZeneca into arms?
They are, but the mess that's been unfolding over the last couple of weeks is very much continuing, and Europe does not seem to be on the same page about this vaccine. So on the one hand, you have several countries that suspended AstraZeneca resuming it, Germany, Spain, Italy, the Netherlands, and others. In fact, just a few hours ago, the Prime Minister of France, Jean Castex, went on live TV. He rolled up his sleeve, and he got the AstraZeneca shot. So you have some countries trying to do damage control to restore public confidence, catch up on vaccinations that weren't done in the last week. But then there are other countries like Denmark that are still holding off and saying, we will not resume with AstraZeneca until we see more data.
Ilana Gordon, what is the latest on the actual risk evaluation of this vaccine?
Yeah, so agencies, regulatory agencies, Marco, have been reviewing this data this week. And the World Health Organization's Vaccine Safety Committee, they just issued an update today. And they concluded that the vaccine's benefits outweigh the risks. The data don't suggest any increase in medical problems and that countries should use it. Here's WHO's director, Tedros Ghebreyesus.
We understand that people may have had concerns about the safety of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. The question with any pharmaceutical or vaccine is whether the risk of taking it is greater or less than the risk of the disease it's meant to prevent or treat. In this case, there is no question. COVID-19 is a deadly disease, and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine can prevent it.
It all appears to echo Europe's main drug regulatory agency stance after their own review, which they came out with yesterday. But the regulators in Europe did say that the vaccine may, in very rare instances, be associated with a very unusual kind of clotting that affects the brain. They're not sure, so what they're doing is adding a new label to the shot so that doctors and nurses pay special attention.
So bottom line, AstraZeneca is linked to blood clots or is not?
No. No proven link. And the thing to understand, Marco, is that medical problems happen in the real world all the time, regardless of vaccines. And so you have clinical trials that track and test safety on tens of thousands of people. But experts tell me that once you start deploying a vaccine in the real world, really rare stuff starts coming up. And it's important to keep in mind that more than 20 million vaccines have been given out in Europe as of this week. So that's a lot. And these cases of serious blood clots in the vaccinated group, it was about 24 in total. And so that compares to what scientists do know, that COVID-19 itself can cause deadly blood clots.
Wow. The disease itself can cause blood clots. So Generally, the vaccine is safe. Lydia Manalidou, has everything that's happened this week impacted the public's perception of the vaccine? Just, you know, public trust.
I spoke about this with Dr. Carsten Wotzel. He's head of the German Society for Immunology. And he told me that waning public trust in the AstraZeneca vaccine is something he's really concerned about.
A lot of people are really anxious right now, and not only the people who got the vaccine, but also people who are scheduled to get the vaccine. And it will take a lot of work to regain their trust.
And he's not just talking about people in Germany. You know, AstraZeneca is the second most available vaccine in the EU right now, behind the Pfizer vaccine. And Dr. Wotzel says it's critical that people show up to get their shots, especially now that many European countries, including Germany, are in the midst of a third wave of infections. Now, I also wanted to know how people being vaccinated were feeling. So I went to a vaccination center in the Athens area, and I spoke with one elderly couple. They were holding hands as they were exiting the building. Theodora Kutsuri, who's in her 80s, had just gotten her second shot of
the Moderna.
So not AstraZeneca, but she said that everything that's happened this week has rattled her, and coming in for this second shot, she was a bit more scared than she was for the first. Also, her husband is scheduled to get the AstraZeneca vaccine in a couple weeks. His wife told me he will be there for his appointment, even though they're a little bit afraid, and even though the way they feel about the AstraZeneca vaccine has changed a little bit over the last week or so.
This last question for you, Ilana Gordon. The AstraZeneca vaccine, we know, is one of an array of available vaccines for COVID right now. Is there an outsized focus on the AstraZeneca vaccine, or is there good reason for the attention?
When you zoom out, so much of the world relies on the Oxford AstraZeneca shot. I was just looking at a vaccine map before a conversation that's tracking where vaccines are going and where. And in many instances, in low-income countries, it's the only shot available right now. This vaccine, Marco, makes up 90% of the ones that are being used through COVAX, which is the global program that's trying to get vaccines equitably distributed around the world. So all in all, it's not the only vaccine, but there's a lot at stake with it.
The World's Alana Gordon, who covers global health for the show, and Lydia Manalidou in Athens, Greece. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Atoning for the past. The Jesuits are trying to do that with a landmark agreement announced this week to recognize the role they played in the dehumanizing practice of slavery. The well-known Order of Catholic Priests is pledging to raise $100 million for the descendants of enslaved people who were once owned and sold by the religious order. The Jesuits say it's just a start. The ultimate goal is to raise $1 billion to improve the lives of future generations and to fund a process of truth and reconciliation. Here's the world's Rupa Shenoy with a backstory of how this agreement came about.
5 years ago, Joe Stewart says he didn't know where his ancestors were from. Then he read a story in the New York Times. It said that in 1838, a group of Jesuits saved Georgetown University from financial collapse by selling 272 enslaved men, women, and children to plantation owners in Louisiana. A few generations later, that was where Stewart grew up.
And for the first time in our lives, we knew where we came from. Those of us who were two and three generations down from the original sale.
Stewart, who served as an altar boy, is one of more than 1,000 descendants of an enslaved man named Isaac Hawkins.
You can imagine how I felt when I found out that the church I attended was the church who enslaved my ancestors.
He and 9 other descendants gathered on a Sunday afternoon. They decided not to seek money for themselves. Instead, they wanted to improve the lives of future descendants. They wrote a petition to the Vatican asking for support. The leader of the Jesuit Society responded, welcoming a dialogue and acknowledging that Jesuits had sinned against God by betraying the descendants' ancestors.
That letter copied a Jesuit by the name of Father Timothy Kosicki.
And it was a month after he received that letter that he called me and invited me to his home in Battle Creek, Michigan.
Father Timothy Kosicki is president of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S.
I flew to his home, and as soon as I walked in the door, he and his wife, Clara, stood there with a container of holy water and asked me to bless their home.
Kosicki says it was the beginning of a process that taught him how much stronger faith is than any institution. He had to confront a painful reality. At one point, the Society of Jesus enslaved an estimated 20,000 people. Yet Kosicki says that history was not well known within the order.
No one had done this before. This was, to my knowledge, the first engagement of the descendants of the enslaved with the descendants of the enslavers. And it was these descendant leaders, Joe Stewart in particular, who had a vision. And instead of saying, look at what you did to my ancestors, said, understand what you did to my ancestors. But now we want to partner with you in something new.
And then together, they came and sat down at the table with myself and my team and requested this support.
Lejeune Montgomery Tebron is president and CEO of the Kellogg Foundation. She helped lead the Jesuits and descendants through a process of mediated healing circles.
We brought two stories, both the Jesuit story and the story of the descendants, together, and we built a shared story.
That's how they came to the agreement announced this week. The Jesuits are pledging to donate $100 million to the newly created Descendants Truth and Reconciliation Foundation. It's a partnership between descendants and Jesuits that'll give scholarships to future descendants and support programs aimed at racial healing. Tebron is one of its trustees.
Now we will be in a phase of trying to build a legacy that changes the narrative of this horrible sin to a very positive legacy that is about uplifting lives.
The foundation doesn't call what it's doing reparations, since it's not going to make direct payments to individuals. But as many institutions examine their ties to slavery, this initiative is possibly the most significant to be announced, certainly by the Catholic Church. Susie Pock is an associate history professor at the Catholic St. John's University in New York. She's examining its ties to slavery.
They are, you know, setting a precedent. And that, I think, is quite significant. What's going to come out of it, I'm not really sure.
There has been criticism since the announcement. Some say more descendants should have been included in the decision-making. Others worry the foundation is underestimating the value of the wealth accrued through the enslavement of African Americans. Still others believe that the initiative should confront slavery's ongoing legacy of white privilege. Jim Bretsky is a professor of theology at the Jesuit John Carroll University in Ohio.
This is a real sea change, but as a white person, we have to do more strategically and more energetically than we have in the past.
The two men who have led this whole process don't pretend it was easy. Father Timothy Kosecki says there's been plenty of anger and tears.
There's been a lot of come to Jesus moments, as we tend to call them, that have just been brutal, raw, and painful. I don't deny that. But that's rooted in how are we going to get to the future?
That was an approach that came out of respect for their ancestors, says Joe Stewart, who's now acting president of the Descendants Truth and Reconciliation Foundation.
There were times that we got mad as hell, and we were not afraid to express that. The difference is you don't wallow in that. You look for the positive thing that can help you move forward toward a bigger goal. And our goal is to heal.
Their ancestors had the sheer tenacity to endure and survive, he says, and so must they. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Compelling and timely stories from around the globe. That's what you hear on The World every weekday. Here's another way to connect with us. We're on Instagram, where you can see some of the people and places behind our radio stories and share your thoughts with our community. Go to theworld.org/Instagram. There's a growing movement to treat damage to the environment as an international crime. There's a word for it, ecocide. That's what Jason Palmer and his team at the Intelligence Podcast dive into this week.
In the 1960s and early 1970s, America's military dumped millions of gallons of chemicals over Vietnam. The compounds were known as the rainbow herbicides, Agents Green, Blue, Pink, Purple, White, and most commonly, Agent Orange.
The use of Agent Orange in Vietnam defoliated much of that country and was an environmental and human disaster. Ecocide happens today in many forms, recent forest fires in the Amazon, for example. Jason Palmer spoke about this with his colleague Rachel Dobbs at The Economist.
The campaign for ecocide to be recognized is chiefly the work of Polly Higgins, who was a barrister and environmental activist who died in 2019. But she lobbied the United Nations for years to have ecocide classed as an international crime. And though they ultimately rejected her proposal, the International Criminal Court did agree to evaluate cases of environmental destruction underneath crimes against humanity. Indeed, there was a case filed against Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, at the beginning of this year, to that effect, from indigenous Amazon leaders over his deforestation of the Amazon, which destroys their livelihoods. But the NGO that Polly Higgins co-founded, the Stop Ecocide Foundation, has been continuing to campaign for this ever since her death and were ultimately responsible for convening the legal panel that is now trying to draft a definition.
Defining ecocide as a category of environmental crimes. That was Rachel Dobbs of The Economist in a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Defining ecocide as a category of environmental crimes. That was Rachel Dobbs of The Economist in a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Okay, I have to share some disappointing news for you speed freaks out there. Auto Racing's FIA World Endurance Championship is not happening today in Florida as scheduled. COVID travel restrictions are keeping international racing teams away. That means American fans will miss the debut of a hot pink and black Ferrari, driven by an all-female lineup from Europe. As Angelica Marine reports from Florence, Italy, these women drivers are on a mission to change their sport.
That roar is from inside a race-ready Ferrari 488 GTE, a hyper-tuned sports car built for endurance racing. A capsule of carbon fiber and rebar steel with a wheel full of buttons. At 170 miles per hour, it sends vibrations that clench your guts. I'm at the Mugello racing track in Tuscany, just outside Florence. It's training day for a tall pilot with a blonde braid. Michelle Gadding squeezes out of her ride pitch black with hot pink streaks. At 27, she's the youngest of the Iron Dames, an all-female professional racing team.
And Iron Dame is a determined, strong-willed woman who has strong goals in her life and who's really passionate about what she's doing.
Gadding started go-karting as a little girl in Denmark. She now competes in Grand Touring Endurance, GTE. Think marathon, but for sports cars, gunning through twisty circuits for hours at a time and racking up an insane amount of laps.
Great move there. Very last minute indeed up the inside from Michelle Gadding.
Very, very feisty, and Gadding is getting...
The Iron Dames are one of just three female teams in the world, burning tires head-to-head with men. They have been praised as a sign of progress by the International Federation of the Automobile, the FIA. So Gadding says each race sends a message.
We fight, we want to win, we want to go for the podiums. And when you do that and you get those podiums, people, they don't question anymore why you're there.
We are 2 hours southwest of Paris.
In 2019, the Iron Dames became the first ever all-female lineup to begin and finish the legendary 24-hour of Le Mans. It's the mother of all endurance races, where teams of pilots drive for a full day and a full night, pausing only seconds to switch tires.
Allez, Manu, good job so far, focused on the race. How do you feel, Ariel? You're okay to stay one more
minute? Last year, they finished in the top 10 at Le Mans. This year, reaching the podium, the top three, would be the ultimate game changer.
That would be fantastic. A dream come true.
That's Deborah Meyer, French financier, entrepreneur, and Ferrari collector. She is also the founder of the Iron Dames.
The Iron Dames project was created in 2018 to promote women in motorsport, to give the possibility to talented women to show all their capacities and skills in a quite competitive environment.
Meyer caught the speed bug racing in Ferrari tournaments. As a pilot and project leader, she's betting big to take her Iron Dames to the top. Because she says, male or female doesn't matter. It's all about the lap time.
Not a question of strength. It's skills. It's hard work. You have to improve and to work on your technique. You have to have the right strategy. And above all, you have to work as a team.
As the French say, work at it till the mayonnaise thickens. Teams like this need million-dollar cars and a traveling crew of coaches, mechanics, engineers, and other staff working 4 to 24 hours around the pilots.
Which is why people like Deborah are so important, because when we get together, we can do so much more.
British pilot Catherine Legg is the latest addition to the Iron Dames. She's done it all. NASCAR, Indy 500, Formula E, and GT. Legg doesn't come from a dynasty of racers or from money. She fought her way into the racing circuits. And she says one of the challenges for women drivers can be getting sponsorship.
Sponsors, a lot of them don't want to see women get hurt, don't necessarily believe that women can win.
In fact, Legg broke both her legs last summer. Now back, she's ready to take care of unfinished business.
I want to go out on a high and win championships and win races, and I want to do it as part of an all-female team, because I think that the first all-female team that does that will put a stamp on it, and then, you know, maybe I help other girls to become the next Iron Dames.
30 races for the Iron Dames to make their mark this season and push for that change, because when women step on the podium, sponsors take notice and more fierce girls find their place in the game. For the world, Angelica Marin, Florence.
And that's our musical checkered flag. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and have a relaxing weekend.